Good afternoon and welcome to Health Styles. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. Well, today on Health Styles, I'm really happy that my colleague Barbara Glickstein will join me a little bit to talk about the Supreme Court decision on the Hobby Lobby case that will impede women's access to contraception. And we'll then hear about the story of a nurse and four-time cancer survivor who is close to setting a world record for running the perimeter of the continental United States. But first, let's start with health news. So some weeks ago, I shared some guidelines for people at risk for heat stroke and other consequences of a hot and humid summer that was being predicted, and indeed, the hot and humid summer is upon us. And so I thought it might be worth repeating some of the cautions that have been issued by the New York City Department of Health. It's actually issued another advisory on how people can reduce their heat health risk and who is vulnerable for health problems arising from the heat. So hot weather can cause heat stroke, and it can exacerbate or worsen chronic medical conditions and may lead to severe complications and even death. Deadly heat waves affect New York City nearly every year and kill more Americans each year on average than all other natural disasters combined. So this is something to take seriously. Air conditioning is the most important way to protect vulnerable individuals on hot days. Now, earlier in the season, New York City was offering free air conditioners to people at low income, but that's not mentioned in this most recent health advisory, and so those may have already been purchased. But you can take some other precautions, and certainly some people need to be particularly mindful of the heat. So who are these people who should be really careful because they may be at high risk for heat-related illness and death? Well, the rates of serious illness and death from extreme heat exposure are increased among older adults who, as you get older, your body doesn't regulate its temperature as well as it did in your younger years. And so older people are generally at higher risk for heat-related injuries. Those people who have chronic heart problems or breathing problems, people with diabetes, or people who are severely obese, people with serious mental health or cognitive problems, people who maybe have dementia or Alzheimer's disease should be carefully monitored, or people with developmental disorders, anything that might impair someone's judgment or ability for self-care, those folks are at high risk, as well as people taking medications that can affect their ability to regulate their temperature. And finally, people who use illicit drugs or drink heavily are at higher risk for heat-related illness and death. Now, contrary to what some people may think, hyperthermia or having your body temperature go too high and having an illness or even dying from your body temperature going too high actually occurs most often by heat in people's own homes, and frequently among people who are living alone and who don't have fully working air conditioners, or people who may only have fans, and fans do not provide sufficient cooling during extremely hot weather. The New York City Department of Health recommends that fans only be used when the air conditioning is on or windows are open, and best to use at night to bring in cooler air from outside. And so I want for those of us in New York City to be particularly mindful of people in our apartment buildings who may be living alone, and it might be worth checking in on them and finding out, do they have air conditioning? Do they have a fan that they can put on at night? But particularly the air conditioning, and making sure that somebody is not becoming hyperthermic, one of your neighbors isn't becoming hyperthermic without people realizing it. So what can you do? Well, one, be alert for the signs and symptoms of heat-related illness, or if you have a chronic medical condition, if your symptoms are getting worse. and use your air conditioner or go to a place with air conditioning. And New York City does have cooling centers available during heat waves. You can call 311 and find out where is there a cooling center near you. For air conditioners with a thermostat, they recommend a setting of no lower than 78 degrees Fahrenheit to provide comfort but without wasting energy. You want to make sure that you're drinking enough fluids. For people with heart disease, this may be a problem because they may be on a fluid restriction. And in that case, you should talk to your primary care provider or your cardiologist about what you should do during heat in terms of fluid intake. And most importantly, again, you know, for caregivers, for family members, for people who are part of a support network of someone with a chronic illness who's isolated in the home or living alone or an older adult, check on them frequently. You know, make sure you're calling, checking in, stopping by, and help them if they need help to stay cool and well hydrated. So for more information on heat illness, you can visit the New York City website of www.nyc.gov/health/heat. That's www.nyc.gov/health/heat. So let's all stay cool during this summer. Next up, Kaiser Health News reports today that some emergency rooms are giving people appointments so they can wait to be seen at home. Well, they're not going to be seen at home, but they can do their waits at home instead of in the emergency rooms, which tend to be quite crazy. Dignity Health runs a large network of hospitals out of San Francisco and is offering online emergency room appointments at St. Francis Memorial Hospital in San Francisco and Sequoia Hospital in Redwood City as a way to overcome the frequently grueling emergency room wait times. And it's starting to spread around the country. I'm not sure if it's in New York City yet, but it is in other places, and people are keeping an eye on this development. Of course, you don't want to use this approach if you're being seen to being seen if you have a serious emergency, so one that may be life-threatening, debilitating, or a really urgent medical condition. So people who should not try to make appointments online for visiting the emergency room should include. So these people should not do the online booking. You should go call 911 or go straight to the emergency room. Are people, patients with chest pain, persistent bleeding, or trouble breathing? But if you have a sprained ankle or a fever or earache or stomach pain or a sore throat, this booking online and waiting at home might just reduce the stress of that emergency room visit and prevent the spread of contagious diseases, which we often don't think about as we're sitting in those emergency rooms. Some critics argue that it won't reduce healthcare costs because many of those who use online bookings don't really need an emergency room. They need an urgent care center or to simply see a primary care provider. And Loma Linda University in University Medical Center in San Bernardino County, California, stopped using the service after too many patients who hadn't made the appointments complained that others were walking in the door and being seen ahead of them. But those who use the online booking service seem to like it. They say when they come into the emergency room, the personnel say, "We were expecting you," and take them in. So let's stay tuned for what happens to this innovation. And next from Reuters and the United Nations News Center is the alarming spread of Ebola virus in West Africa countries. This is the largest and deadliest outbreak of Ebola that started this year in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Now, Ebola virus disease, or Ebola hemorrhagic fever, is the human disease caused by Ebola viruses that can also infect animals. Symptoms start 2 days to 3 weeks after contracting the virus and include fever and throat and muscle pains and headaches. And then what develops is nausea, vomiting, and severe diarrhea, often followed by a decline in functioning of the liver and kidneys. And at some point, people start having problems with bleeding, which is why it's called Ebola hemorrhagic fever. There is no specific treatment for the disease, only supportive care such as rehydration. As a result, the virus kills up to 90% of people who contract it. This disease is highly contagious. It's spread through contact with blood or bodily fluids. For example, men who survive may be able to transmit the disease sexually for nearly 2 months. Preventive measures include vigilant hand washing and hygiene and isolation of infected people. Now, in West Africa, where the Ebola virus outbreak is occurring, and every once in a while we hear about somebody having Ebola in this country, but we haven't had this kind of an outbreak. In West Africa, the outbreak has killed 467 people since February. The World Health Organization has identified the main factors that are driving the spread of Ebola in West African countries as the burial of victims in accordance with traditions that bring exposure to bodily fluids, the dense population in some of the West African cities, and a bustling cross-border trade across the region. And so the alarming spread of the virus led the World Health Organization to hold a two-day meeting of West African health ministers this week to address containing the spread of Ebola and marshaling the resources that are needed to do so, since these countries lack resources to prevent the spread of Ebola. Sierra Leone announced this week that President Ernest Bai Koroma and his vice president and all cabinet ministers would donate half of their salaries to help fight the outbreak, although it's doubtful that the amount of money this makes available will have an impact on containing the spread of the virus. There has been a call for offering people at high risk of dying from the virus access to experimental medicines, despite the drugs not having been fully tested. So stay tuned for the developments on Ebola virus. Now, of course, one of the most important health stories of the week is the Supreme Court's ruling in the Hobby Lobby case that allows some employers to exclude contraception coverage from their health plans, despite the Affordable Care Act's requirement for health plans to offer contraception for free to women, with some limited exceptions. And I'm really pleased to say that my colleague and co-host and co-producer of Health Styles, Barbara Glickstein, is an expert in this area, stays on top of these issues, and is joining me today to talk about this important Supreme Court story. Barbara, thanks for taking the time today to come on when it was my turn.
No, Diana, it's always great to join you on the air. And of course, this is the week that we must talk about this and have a response, as Health Styles likes to do or feels critical to do, to respond to current changes in health policy impacted this week by Monday's Supreme Court decision in the case of Burwell versus Hobby Lobby, which is absolutely going to affect access to contraception for millions of women across the United States.
So the Affordable Care Act requires free coverage for contraception. So women don't have to pay a copay. They don't have to pay for the contraception. It's expected that the insurance plan will cover the contraception. And the Act did make exceptions for religious organizations.
Yes, just schools and churches. The area of not-for-profits is, again, under the law that was passed under President Clinton, which had to do with the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, that allowed people to seek exemptions from a federal law that, quote, substantially burdened, end quote, their religious expression unless they further a, quote, compelling government interest, end quote, that couldn't be achieved through less restrictive means. So as you stated, Diana, first off, the Affordable Care Act included some critical issues around preventative care, and after a great fight, successfully, the women's health issues were included but not limited to birth control as part of preventative health, as part of a health care plan that would be included without a copay, hugely impacting women across the country whose plans either hadn't covered it, their employer hadn't covered it, and also where the copays in some instances and in some women's lives made it impossible for them to afford to their monthly either oral contraceptive or having an IUD inserted or whatever method of contraception they were choosing that was based on their own personal health, their own personal decisions. So it was a big success. As a feminist, as a woman, I state that. As a nurse, I state that. And this this challenge to the Affordable Care Act is the first one since, of course, as you and I both remember, holding our breaths in 2012, yes, when the Supreme Court ruled and upheld most of the law but struck down the provision compelling states to expand Medicaid state insurance programs for the poor, something that we're seeing since the Affordable Care Act has been rolled out in those states that did not mandate it or did not impact their communities and accept the expansion of Medicaid. We're beginning to see how many, many thousands of people are still without access to health care through an insurance plan.
And some states are realizing they're losing out and are now exploring whether they can actually get their legislatures, because it does require an act of the legislature to expand the program, whether the legislature, a couple states are trying to move their legislatures to act. So we're hoping that
some
of that will change.
I think that what we are very concerned about, and I know we want to get back to the Burwell versus Hobby Lobby decision, is that we live in a system, we have a healthcare system where for most Americans, their employment is tied to their health insurance. And this, as certainly Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg stated eloquently in her dissent, that this is a very slippery slope and that we have some grave concerns that this decision can impact, including what may be other ways of chipping away on provisions that are currently made available to people under the Affordable Care Act, as well as others. Just in today's news, for example, on Monday, President Obama issued a executive order barring employment discrimination on the basis of gender identity and sexual orientation for businesses with any federal contracts. And he is receiving letters from all over the country by organizations who are asking to now be exempt from that executive order because of their religious convictions against the LGBT community. So whether that will fly, we don't know. But certainly this expansion of corporations being considered having the same rights as individuals, or in this case, a privately owned, however, what's called closely held corporation, is now being has an exemption to providing contraceptives to those who work for them through their health insurance plans.
And Barbara, my read is that the Supreme Court essentially granted the employer, these businesses, the closely held businesses, actually more of a right than the women. The women who are their employees who might need access to free birth control are being denied that at this point by their employer.
Absolutely. This it does exactly that. It was initially that there were two forms of birth control, both being intrauterine devices, or known as IUDs, and there were two brands of emergency contraception that were brought up on this case. Both the owners brought this case believe they cause abortion. So there's a tremendous amount of myth and bad science, in addition to many organizations, scientists, nurses, medical colleagues, who reported that, in fact, they are not abortifacients or do not cause abortions, but in fact they are a contraceptive method that prevents pregnancy, a very different method of use. However, The five justices, who we all know were all men. I also want to add they were all Roman Catholic men, who, in fact, voted in the majority and supported this analysis. We do know that also when we refer to the closely held corporation, something that a term I wasn't familiar with, and I don't know how many of our listeners were, perhaps they are now since it's been quoted so much since Monday, it makes up about 90% of all the corporations in this country. And so owners who are going to be asserting that they have a personal objection to contraceptions can place themselves in a similar place, and this really will impact millions of women. Just in general, the IRS defines a closely held corporation as one that has more than 50% of the value of its outstanding stock owned directly or indirectly by five or fewer individuals.
They have consensus on their board, among these people, the board, the governing board, they have consensus about this belief. Isn't that the other requirement?
I don't believe so, but you may be right. I didn't read that. I'm not sure it has to have board approval, and I'm wondering whether some of our activism or stretches, as you know, the companies, there are about 100 companies and growing who are now saying they'll be enforcing this. I'll pick on one, but it's not the only one. Eden Organic Products, sold widely, is a very outspoken anti-birth control, anti-choice, reproductive rights, and they have, in fact, also said they will be instituting this. So, if we just talk about Hobby Lobby alone, they own almost 600 stores across the United States. Most of the workers in those stores are making minimum wage, and so what's also been pointed out is if your employer is not covering you for contraception, and that will not be available to you through your employer insurance in any one of these countries. For our listeners, you need to know, for example, an IUD insertion in a primary care GYN provider's office can cost up to $500. That could be someone's wages for a month. And the other denial is on emergency contraception. Again, an emergency contraception is not an abortion. They do prevent pregnancy in the event that there was a mishap with the use of a contraception or failed contraception. However, again, this is where science was trumped by politics, and unfortunately the Supreme Court decision didn't necessarily look at the specifics of what they were asserting as these contraceptive methods being abortions. It really ruled on the rights of corporations that were closely held to state their religious beliefs as being a reason enough not to provide this preventative health care under the Affordable Care Act.
So what are some of the options that women will have who are working for these companies?
Well, Diana, it's interesting. I've been searching since this decision came down, and there really isn't anything besides two actions at least politically, in D.C., that I can share with the listeners. The first is that the White House is considering whether President Obama can take unilateral action to ensure that they're covered, and that, in fact, this ruling would use similarly to how it's currently covering women who work for nonprofit, religiously affiliated schools and churches. And that's how, under the accommodation that the federal government has agreed to provide waivers, and they are not fining these organizations who don't want to cover contraception, and the insurer or third-party plan administrator is covering it instead. So it takes it out of the employer and puts it into the administrator of the plan, the third-party plan, and actually the cost is then borne by the insurer or, in some cases, the government.
So my understanding, though, was that the employer has to submit a written form to essentially have the insurer take this on,
well,
and that they're claiming that
is being considered. How it will work with these now closely held corporations is just one idea that's circulating mainly in the Democratic Party. And, of course, President Obama's statement on Monday after the decision was in support of women having access to contraception. Timothy Jost, who runs Health Affairs blog, says it's just the government's preference that employers administer the coverage, but the obligation to provide contraception is technically on the insurers. So this is sort of a workaround that the government's trying to, that I think there are some closed-door discussions going on so that under the Affordable Care Act, the employer won't be exposed to the cost, but it would be the third-party insurer.
Yeah, but they would have to request it, and my understanding is that Hobby Lobby would also sue, saying that if they have to file this form with the insurer, that that in itself is being complicit with something that's going against their beliefs. So
I'm sure they're going to use every possible
strategy
not to provide birth control coverage. The other option is that is being discussed is the amending the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act to make it tighter, and that in fact the American Progress Institute has put out a policy statement. But as you and I discussed before going on the air, getting anything passed in Washington these days is absolutely impossible. And so both of these options are struggles. This is definitely going to be used and has been, Harry Reid spoke about it, Nancy Pelosi has spoken about it. This is absolutely an issue that will become a front runner in the 2014 election.
I've been thinking about this and wondering, why doesn't a group like Planned Parenthood or another group that really their mission is around family planning and reproductive health, why couldn't there be a campaign to raise monies to be able to make contraception available to women who for free who cannot get it through their employer?
Well, I think that would be brilliant, only that they're constantly struggling with all the defunding they are impacted
yes.
By state. The number of family planning centers through Planned Parenthood, as you know, has been limited, as well as we have states that have no access or one clinic in an entire area. In addition, you know, I don't know if we have time to discuss it,
yes.
But just last week, the buffer zone and the protection of women entering centers where they're seeking a termination of pregnancy has been removed by the Supreme Court, and agitation and confrontation, both aggressive and hostile, has been made easier by the Supreme Court's decision that it's a freedom of speech issue. I think what is happening in terms of how, you know, who will be providing this contraception and how will it be paid for is one that you and I should follow closely. I do want to mention that women of color are particularly going to be impacted by this decision. Many of them who work in industries and in businesses like Hobby Lobby, where minimum wage and uninsured, in some instances, you know, part-time work that doesn't cover their insurance, or if they're lucky to have insurance and now not have insurance cover their contraception. But I mentioned a moment ago, low-wage workers, the cost of an IUD can be prohibitive without insurance coverage up to $500. And the challenge of co-pays, for example, black women have the highest rates of unintended pregnancies in the country, and one in five black women will experience rape in her lifetime. Access to emergency contraception really is critical in order to provide autonomy in terms of reproductive choice and termination of unwanted pregnancies. You know, I know I certainly have been bombarded with some fantastically written articles and issues that have been covered as a result of this decision. There's a lot of anger, and there's also some actions going on, and I just want to mention them, Diana. I'm seeing websites going up giving women advice on how to purchase birth control online. I'm seeing advice of women how you can terminate a pregnancy without having a health care provider. You know, having been involved in reproductive rights and women's rights since the early 70s, before the Supreme Court decision on Roe v. Wade. I am both very concerned about this, and at the same time, as we know, a woman who wants to terminate her pregnancy will go to many means in order to do that. Preventing pregnancy, the whole issue of choosing when and how many children you want to have is another discussion. And certainly what I see, and I'll state this very, very much from my personal viewpoint, is this is not only about not being supporting terminations of pregnancy. This is really about controlling women's lives. And whether it's what has happened now is, I think, a strong statement that I hope all of you who are listening and across this country show your support in the elections coming up this fall, in terms of what 99% of all American women have used birth control or are using birth control. For this decision to have passed so easily by our Supreme Court justices without a response is one that I think we should all be enraged about.
And I might point out that indeed Hobby Lobby was not withdrawing its coverage of Viagra.
Vasectomies.
And what? Vasectomies, right. So the other thing is, there, I read something online today that said that indeed Hobby Lobby invests in its employee pension plan. They invest in companies that make birth control products. So
that's right.
They're really talking out of both sides of their mouth, it sounds.
Well, I mean, I will be curious to see, I posted on Facebook 2 days ago for my friends who are hobbyists and crafters, many of them, where else can we direct our viewership to purchase their crafts?
Yeah.
And I've gotten many, many wonderful crafters who've made some great recommendations, including to smaller online businesses. And there is a movement, and I don't want to, harass our craftspeople and artists, but there is also a movement on Etsy, the online craft, individual store, that unless someone can prove that they're not purchasing their crafts from Hobby Lobby, we should boycott them.
Good. And so for people who have other ideas about how to respond to this issue, can you recommend some, are there any Twitter handles or Twitter hashtags that people are tweeting about, or any kinds of social media that particularly are focused on now, what do we do?
I think you should just continue listening to WBAI and getting updates there. There are just hundreds of people writing about this, more than hundreds of people writing about this. And on Twitter, it can either be the hashtag #RepoRights or Hobby Lobby. There are many of them floating that will allow you to follow these actions. I personally follow Reality Tech. It's my go-to resource both online, and I read every day. They have very, very good articles that are constantly updating this. Gawker has a really great article on the Treasury of Justice Ginsburg's talk on her Hobby Lobby dissent, if you haven't read that. And, I think writing to those companies, if you are someone who purchases any of the products from the list of companies that have already been identified, let them know that you will no longer be shopping there. I do think we can reuse the power of the purse.
Yes, although it's a little bit overwhelming when you think that 60 to 90% of the companies in this country could be protesting this. It could be following in Hobby Lobby's footsteps and not offering contraception.
Yeah, of course, it'll be, well, as one quote, I'm sorry, I can't remember who said this, as I saw one quote that said, a corporation that has never announced their religious beliefs in such a strong way will be challenged if they step forward now and say it's for religious reasons. So I mentioned the percentage of those that are closely held in the United States, but the religious viewpoint will be challenged. I hope are challenged, I should say. I don't know.
Yeah. So let me just remind listeners, you're listening to Health Styles on WBAI 99.5 FM. I'm Diana Mason, and I'm here talking with my friend and colleague Barbara Glickstein about the Supreme Court decision this week. And just in the remaining few minutes here, Barbara, say a little bit more about the buffer zone. So for people who, you mentioned it earlier, explain what the buffer zone is and what this Supreme Court decision is going to mean in terms of what people might experience and see at sites that offer women's access to reproductive health services.
This was a case that was challenged in the state of Massachusetts regarding the buffer zone that was instituted in order to protect the rights of women who were entering into clinics where terminations of pregnancies were being given for women who were choosing not to continue their pregnancy. And the Supreme Court ruled that the buffer zones for protesters were, in fact, not constitutionally protected for the rights of those who were there to speak to and petition those women who are stepping into either a Planned Parenthood or what other mainly Planned Parenthoods have been targeted to convince them not to terminate that pregnancy. And this was a law that was struck down on June 26th unanimously, the protesters had a First Amendment right to speech. The interesting thing and observation was that the case was brought forth by a woman named McCullen, a 77-year-old grandmother who carries knit baby hats outside the clinic and wants to hand them to the women. And so this was a strategic tactic by the community that supported this protest to be allowed to protest. So they have removed the buffer zone and saying it's legal. And now those zones or bubble zones, protective zones, will have to be removed. And these patients and staff at the clinic will, in fact, be subjected to the advances of people who sit there. They sit outside. They stand up. They walk over. They hand them flyers. They show them pictures that that are difficult to see, and in some instances, by the time a woman who's entering is quite upset, and this can be quite disturbing to all of those who are joining them as well. I think for another time, I can talk to you about this. What this also was chosen to do is that we know, in addition to harassments and murders in clinics of practitioners who have been providing these services, it seems as though there's been one more step taken away to protect those who work there, as well as those who are entering, not to be harassed or potentially subject to physical harm.
So it's very disturbing. I mean, you've been doing this work, as you said, since before Roe v. Wade, and to see that gain and then to see continual cutbacks on the rights of women in this country, it's very disturbing and hard to... just hard to live with at times. And I know that you're an activist on this issue, and I know that you are totally committed to this issue, and I certainly appreciate all the work you do, Barbara, on behalf of all women and families.
Diana, we're both nurses, and
yeah.
First of all, however our listener audience, wherever they stand on this issue, abortion is legal in this country.
Yes.
And similar to access to contraception through the Affordable Care Act, that was legislated. So I am here to uphold the law in addition to provide safe, quality information and care for people who are seeking health care. And I think that drives the work that we do as public health nurses and health reporters here on Health Styles.
Well, thank you, Barbara Glickstein, so much for coming on Health Styles today. And they're going to hear, listeners, you will hear Barbara next week. She's hosting the program next week. And do you know what's on the radar screen yet? Or
I'm going to let you know later on today.
Okay. Thank you so much, Barbara.
All
have
right.
A wonderful holiday
you
weekend.
Have a great rest of the show. Thanks,
Thanks.
For everyone's attention.
Bye-bye. All right. So, then my good colleague Barbara Glickstein, co-director of the Center for Health Media and Policy, co-host, co-producer of Health Styles. She's, as I said, been an activist in the area of reproductive health rights for women for decades. So, excuse me, I thank her for coming on today. And now to close the program, I want to bring you the story, or a sort of remarkable story, of a woman who is a nurse, a four-time cancer survivor, who has been running around the perimeter of the United States and is going to be setting a world record. I made a mistake earlier in the program. I said in a couple days, but actually the world record will be set next year when she finishes the fourth leg of this race around the perimeter of the contiguous United States. Her name is Helene Neville, and she will be wrapping up her third transcontinental run on Sunday, this Sunday, in Harborview Memorial Park in Portland, Maine. She just went through New York City, I believe, and this is a 2,000-mile journey over 68 days that began on May 1 this year in Marathon, Florida. What a place to start. Helene Neville, thanks so much for joining us on Health Styles. Are you there, Helene?
Hi, yes I am.
Good. Thank you for joining us on Health Styles. Where are you at the moment?
I just entered New Hampshire.
Ah.
5 miles ago.
And
5 miles into New Hampshire.
And where were you in New York? Did you come through the city?
I sure did. I ran the entire length of Manhattan.
That's fabulous. So why are you doing this?
Well, my original plan was I wrote a book, Nurses in Shape, in 2010, and came up with this idea that what if I just show up at all the hospitals across the country and kind of encourage nurses to become better ambassadors for health and promote the message from the book. And I did just that, and I realized the journey wasn't over, that I want to try to reach as many nurses as possible. And so I continue.
But you're also reaching the public at large with your message.
And you're exactly right. I've reached so many nurses. And so now I'm going into schools. I'm talking to caregivers, support groups of cancer patients, and just the general public, like you said. And so it's kind of morphed into really everybody.
So
and I love talking to the kids. They have, you know, kids. Their questions are great.
So share your story here about you are a four-time cancer survivor.
Yeah, I was in the 90s. I was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma. Went through chemo, radiation, and then it abscessed in my brain, which I had to have 3 brain surgeries just to get rid of all the disease in there. And I had a lot of setbacks, but I just kept going and took on running and bodybuilding and mountain climbing. And then in 2009, I was turning 50. In 2010, I thought I wanted to do something more. And that's when I came up with writing a book and going on the road. And then in 2011, I was diagnosed cell lymphoma. Was treated for that, and as soon as I was done, I started running from Canada to Mexico.
So I read about that you had undergone 3 brain surgeries, and I thought the brain surgeries must have affected this woman. She's running 10,000 miles. I am not a runner, I'm a walker, but I would never make 10,000 miles. So
yeah, people have said that to me. Like either they left something in or took out too many things.
So you're essentially running some days a whole marathon.
Well, yesterday I ran 53 miles.
How many?
Oh, 53. 5-3.
5-3. So, how are you doing this?
It's just, you know, a lot of will. I really stick to nutrition. I have a great training regimen and willpower. I don't know. I love it. So the passion kind of comes through.
And I'm
very focused, really focused.
So your experience with cancer shifted how you thought about your life?
I think so. Actually, I think it made me realize that, you know, I was in the hospital quite often, and my sons were young at the time, so I wanted to create positive memories for them. Mm-hmm. You never know when your time's up, and so I thought, you know, if they see me training for something fun, or, well, it was fun to me.
Yeah.
Maybe people don't consider it fun. The bodybuilding, and, you know, I competed in some shows, and I just wanted to just really, it was all about positive memories versus replacing those terrible memories. Mm. You know, why did I have to come to the hospital to see their mom? Mm. So that's why I started doing all those things.
So do you have a team of people with you?
Well, that's part of the uniqueness of the story. I actually prefer to be alone. I'm literally dropped on the highway, and I call them 6 or 10 hours later and have them come pick me up. So I'm completely alone, and people are very nervous about just dropping me in the middle of nowhere.
And do you have water on you? You have some food on you? Do you?
Yes. Yeah, I carry what I need, the essentials, really everything I need to survive for that day on my back. But I do consume most of my calories at night after the run.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it just works for recovery, and it's enough to get me through most of the following day.
So
well, it's 25 miles. The 50 miles, I have to stop and eat.
Mm-hmm.
For some reason, I have this craving for chips. And I could tell you from Canada to Mexico, I think there's chips along the entire way because I didn't eat them, I just licked them.
So what's been the greatest challenge of trying to do this?
Well, at first it was money, and then, you know, there's always a better way. I thought if it's grassroots, and the best way is getting a community together and starting small for me. Whether it's my friends, you know, I would call people, say, hey, buy a T-shirt, or it was very hard to get sponsors at first. And then we figured out that we could just do it. I just believe that, you know, nurses are innovative. It's kind of in our DNA, and we can stretch a dollar as far as it can be stretched. But the greatest challenge, you know, I think is really seeing, I try to expose what's right with nursing and what's right with our country, but the greatest challenge is really seeing all the devastation, poverty, the destruction.
Mm.
Things that, you know, there's doom and gloom on the news, but what isn't revealed is how we live every single day, and there's always somebody worse off. Mm. So I want to try to see them up close and personal and meet them and greet them.
So as you're doing this run, do you stop and meet people, or you're doing this at the end of your
all
trip?
All the time, yeah. During the run, I'll knock on people's doors if I'm hungry.
And what reception do you get?
The host. People have, because I'm really covered up, and then on top of that, I wear this white zinc oxide on my face. I look like the Batman. Or the Joker from Batman running to do gardening or something. I look really ridiculous. And people will go open their door and literally kind of, it's almost like they look up to the skies for the flying saucer that dropped me off.
Mm.
In the middle of nowhere, the most poverty-ridden area, and here I'm at their door.
Mm.
An old lady with this crazy costume on.
And how do they respond to your story?
They just love it. They, you know, some people don't even know where Maine is or where Canada is. They just can't fathom what it's do all those things. And but once they hear, just, you know, that maybe I didn't start on the level playing field as most people, but they see me out there and think, well, she's out doing that at her age after the things she's been through. What could I do? And I think it just kind of gets the wheels spinning. And then they find out you're a nurse and they ask you about every ailment. And
Of course. So your journey started in 2010. You ran.
That's correct.
Yes, and across the South during a hot summer.
I started May 1st, ran through, Arizona, New Mexico, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, through the heat of the summer, and 2010 was a pretty hot summer. But I thought, nurses, we have that unique knowledge of intake versus output.
And yeah.
Nursing is about giving and not giving up, so who better to do it?
And then in 2013, you ran from Canada down to San Diego?
Tijuana.
And that was 45 days, 1,500 miles.
Yeah, 45 days. And that was a tough run. There was a lot of hills. I thought going north to south, it would be downhill the whole way. But I thought wrong.
And then this run is from Marathon, Florida to Maine, and I'm interested in where you run. Do you run along highways?
Yeah, I run on Route 1 mostly on this run.
Oh.
I run against traffic. I run north in the southbound lane. Mm-hmm. There's been times where it's a little challenging, where there's no shoulders or... Even though it's not an interstate, people sure go fast.
Yeah.
And so you have to be alert. And, I think I surprise a lot of people when they're coming around the bend. They're like, oh, my gosh, what is that?
So you are also raising money as you do this, and you have a website?
Yes, One on the Run, O-N-E, spelled out, oneontherun.com. And the charity, so we're just a little part of the whole piece, and my mom attended a school in Philadelphia, which is now pretty devastated, and there's just these little, cute little nuns that do everything, including all of the fundraising. The school is basically on their own, and they produce scholars and 100% graduation rate. It's really amazing. And in my mom's honor, memory, we created this fund after she passed away, and those little nuns have jumped in their nunmobile, and they've been to both finish lines already.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah, it's such an uplifting place to be, and it's really amazing what they do. And so when I was in Philly, I ran right to the school. That was really neat.
And let me just repeat one more time that the website is www.oneontherun.com. We've been talking with Helene Neville, who is next year setting a world record for running 10,000 miles across the contiguous, the perimeter of the United States. And next year you'll be running from where to where?
I'll start in St. Stephen's, New Brunswick, and then intersect the point I stop or end at this run, which is Portland, Maine.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll head across the top, like Illinois. I'll hit all the states. My son's a dentist in Iowa. I'll stop and get my teeth cleaned north. Minnesota, and then I have another son who's a college coach in North Dakota, and then I'll go across the top, finish in Olympic Beach, Washington.
Well, that's fabulous. And I want to wish you well on your run.
Thank you so much.
That the people in Maine, in Harborview Memorial Park in Portland, Maine, will be there to cheer you on and for people to look at what you're doing next year and maybe join you on some of that run. So go to www.oneontherun.com. Thank you to nurse and cancer survivor Helene and runner Helene Neville. Thank you so much, Helene. Enjoy
thank
your
you
weekend.
Thank you so much. And we have a Facebook page, too.
Okay, facebook.com/oneontherun. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, to listeners, thank you so much for joining us today on this day before July 4th. I'm Diana Mason, one of the producers of this program, Health Styles, that's brought to you by the Center for Health Media and Policy at Hunter College, City University of New York. You can follow us online at www.centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. That's centerforhealthmediapolicy.com. Have a great weekend, and thanks to Reggie for engineering the program.